Sleep. The moonlight is shining on the foot of my bed, lying there like a large, bright, flat stone. Whenever the disc of the full moon begins to shrink and its right-hand side starts to wither, like a face approaching old age, in which one cheek becomes hollow and wrinkled first, that is the time when at night I am seized by a dark and agonizing restlessness. I am not asleep, nor am I awake. And in my reverie, things I have seen mingle with things I have read or heard, like rivers of different colour or clarity meeting. I had been reading about the life of the Buddha before I went to bed, and one passage kept on running through my mind in a thousand variations, going back to the beginning again and again. A crow flew to a stone which looked like a lump of fat, thinking perhaps it had found something good to eat. But when the crow found that it was not good to eat, it flew off. Like the crow that went to the stone, so do we the tempters, leave Gotama the ascetic, because we have lost our pleasure in him. And the image of the stone that looked like a lump of fat grew in my mind to enormous dimensions. I am walking along a dried-up riverbed, picking up smooth pebbles, bluish-grey ones with specks of glittering dust. I rack my brains, but I still have no idea what to do with them. Then I find black ones with patches of sulphurous yellow, like the petrified attempts of a child to form crude, blotched salamanders. I want to throw them away, these pebbles, far away from me, but they keep just falling out of my hand, and I cannot banish them from my sight. Is the opening page there from Gustav Meyrink's The Golem. And this is the 95 translation from by Mike Mitchell, and this is Daedalus Publishers, who I highly recommend. The Golem by Meyrink was originally published in serialization, in serialized form, between 1913 and 1914. In a way, this matters when you read it. There's these different sections which have titles such as Sleep, Day, Prague, Punch, Night, Snow. And then when we get to the end, the section is just called End. So this was published in serialized form. It was written, however, over 7 years, between 1907 and 1914. And then after the serialized form had finished in 1914, it was eventually first published as The Golem or Der Golem in 1915. There was a couple of English translations, and then I'm reading the Mike Mitchell 95 translation. Before I go into what The Golem is, what the book is, and who Meyrink was, which I will add in here, there is a testament, if you like, to this novel, and I can think of no greater compliment, in a way, than this. And this is from one H.P. Lovecraft, who said the novel is one of the best examples of Jewish folklore-inspired weird fiction. And, to quote, he called it the most magnificent weird thing I've come across in aeons. So, to describe the book in a sentence, without even going into its content, The Golem, by Meyrink, is the book that H.P. Lovecraft called weird. And that is how you know you are about to get into some strange, strange waters. So it's almost, I'm almost going to have to do an encapsulation. Then I'll go through to the plot, what there is. As many of the books that I review, it's always the question of what is the plot and of what plot there is. And then I'll talk about Meyrink as well. And then look at some of the specifics. So the novel, as per the title, is based on the Jewish legend about a rabbi who made a living being known as a golem out of clay. And this becomes animated via a Kabbalistic spell, a Kabbalistic ritual. And although the actual legends themselves don't really have too much to do with the story's plotline, though one could argue that the Kabbalistic tradition is possibly hidden in the text, and so is the tradition of the tarot. The main character is Athanasius Pernath from Prague, is amidst a ghetto in Prague in which the golem, a literal golem, but also possibly a figurative abstract golem, is both a character and also, you could say, an abstract force that is haunting this ghetto. And before I go into the plot from Pernath and what's happening as much as one can grasp, which I will of course cover as to why it's difficult to grasp, I'll give you another excerpt as to the sort of thing we're dealing with. Perhaps it is right here among us, every hour of the day, only we cannot perceive it. You can't hear the noise from a vibrating tuning fork until it touches wood and sets it resonating. Perhaps it is simply a spiritual growth without any inherent consciousness, a structure that develops like a crystal out of formless chaos according to a constant law. Who can say? Just as on sultry days the static electricity builds up to unbearable tension until it discharges itself in lightning, could it not be that the steady build-up of those never-changing thoughts that poison the air in the ghetto leads us to a sudden spasmodic discharge? A spiritual explosion blasting our unconscious dreams out into the light of day and creating, as the electricity does the lightning, a phantom that in expression, gait and behaviour, in every last detail, would reveal the symbol of the soul of the masses. If only we were able to interpret the secret language of forms. And just as there are natural phenomena which suggest that lightning is about to strike, so there are certain eerie portents which presage the eruption of that spectre into the physical world. The plaster flaking off a wall will resemble a person striding along the street. The frost patterns on windows will form into the lines of staring faces. The dust drifting down from the roofs will seem to fall in a different way from usual, suggesting to the observant that it is being scattered by some invisible intelligence lurking hidden in the eaves in a secret attempt to create all sorts of strange patterns. Whether the eye rests on a uniform sameness of texture or focuses on irregularities of the skin, we fall prey to our unwelcome talent for discerning everywhere significant, ominous shapes which grow to gigantic proportions in our dreams. And always, behind the spectral attempts of these gathering swarms of thoughts to gnaw through the walls surrounding our everyday existence, we can sense with tormenting certainty that our own inmost substance is, deliberately and against our will, being sucked dry so that the phantom may take on physical form. So, it's a tough book, but it's tough and it's enjoyable. It's one of these difficult texts where once you sit back and accept that, and this is why I think the understanding that it was first in a serialized form, so, you know, you'd get a part every month or every week or whatever it was, an understanding that that was how it was originally published helps one develop this appreciation of what is going on in the text. And if you read it and think you're going into a straightforward novel in which you are going to be given this plot as to what the golem is, what it means, and what is happening to Pernath, you would enter into it confused. And if you were to enter into it in the idea that you're going to understand what exactly who Pernath is and what is happening to him, the protagonist Athanasius Pernath, you would also come away fairly confused. And I think in this serialized form, you are given in these ways these titles of the section: Sleep, Day, Prague, Punch, Night, Awake. You are given these artistic, intensely creative and esoteric events, pieces of this fragmented whole to enter into as an experience, as opposed to a linear or railed journey. But if I'm to try reel in and give you some plot, because there is a plot here that one can venture into, like a sort of to be honest, a sort of esoteric, almost the feeling of a murder mystery, as if you're getting all these hints and clues amidst this palpable paranoia, as to you're trying to work out a question. And it begins, you know, the section that I began with there, which is right the first page, beginning with a sort of perhaps a red herring of the it begins ultimately with the word sleep. And this begins the question of, where are we? Are we in reality? Are we in a dream? Are we in a hallucination? Whose mind are we in? Who's in control? What are we seeing? Whose perspective are we seeing this from? So the notion of the unreliable narrator is immediate, and it's narrators stacked upon narrators within narrators. I'll get to that. But the novel ultimately centers on the life of Athanasius Pernath, a jeweler and art restorer who lives in the ghetto of Prague. And for me, the actual ghetto, this setting, this ghetto in Prague, is the ultimate character of this novel. But Pernath's story is experienced by an anonymous narrator who, during a visionary dream, so we're beginning with sleep, assumes Pernath's identity 30 years before. This dream was perhaps induced because he inadvertently swapped his hat with the real old Pernath. And while the novel is generally focused on Pernath's own musings and adventure, it chronicles the lives of various characters and interactions with friends and neighbours within the ghetto, many of them taking on very almost clear-cut archetypal roles with respect to Pernath's spiritual journey. The golem, however, as per the title, the golem is rarely seen, but is central to the novel. It's a haunting figure of something that perhaps we're trying to avoid, something that occasionally enters and gives you this just horrid sense of uncanny and dread. It's a representative, as per the description. I'll go a bit more into the lore behind the lore of the reality of the golem in Judaic history. It's a representative of the ghetto's own spirit and consciousness. It's brought to life by the ghetto's suffering, uncanniness, the misery, and what has been endured by this place that we have been placed within. The story is fragmented, and not just because of the serialization. We are constantly thrown into, we're given, it's a book of doubles, of triples, of quadruples. What do I mean by that? There's red herrings. There's symbols that are so obvious that you doubt them. Everything is second-guessed. There's doppelgangers. There is this narrator who is being possessed by another narrator who may very well be asleep. Everything is falling into dreams. The imagery takes on a life of its own within the image. We are constantly second-guessing reality, akin to something, maybe it could be described to those who are familiar with the work of Philip K. Dick. It is like Philip K. Dick meets John Dee meets H.P. Lovecraft. We are constantly doubting reality. And if you want to retain your sanity whilst going through this novel, much like Pernath, if you want to retain your sanity and take from that question right at the beginning of the crow who finds the lump of fat and wants to stay with it, of this question of why, what is this thing that I've found? You can't seek to control it. You have to allow yourself, much like a dream, when you try to seek to control a dream, it ruins it, and you're taken into something that is no longer really dreamlike. You have to be carried along by it. But it's carried along by something that at times isn't nice, that is haunting, that is dreadful, that is uncanny, that makes you feel kind of unwell at times. And so the reality of the narrator's experience, who we know is this doubled-up narrator, the ultimate unreliable narrator, who may not even be real, ultimately. And so what is happening may not even be happening. The reality of the narrator's experience is always called into question, and the end of the novel calls the whole thing into question. And the novel's serialized parts are always also calling things into question. Of course, we're beginning in sleep. We're beginning with sleep, then it's night, and then it's awake, and then it's fear is another one. Ruse, free, end. These are all very abstract places to be. And so what may be dreams might be metaphysical, spiritual events with regards to some real that is transforming throughout time. But it's also revealed throughout the book, and Pernath, he is central in this way, but what exactly is Pernath? It's revealed that he suffered a mental breakdown at least one occasion and has no memory of the event. So this is a traumatic individual, a traumatic essence that is sort of being fragmented and spewed throughout the ghetto with these haunting, paranoid characters throughout. And the stability of all things is constantly called into question. And so this is the kind of novel, this is the kind of atmosphere that we're entering into. It's a heavily atmospheric novel, and that's what you need to go into it with, as a sort of strange crossing the abyss spiritual journey. I'll give you another excerpt here. I have lived here for a generation, and in that time I have formed the impression, which I cannot shake off, that there are certain hours of the night, or in the first light of dawn, when they confer together in mysterious, noiseless agitation, and sometimes a faint, inexplicable quiver goes through their walls. Noises scurry across the roof and drop into the gutter, and with our dulled senses we accept them heedlessly without looking for what causes them. Often I dreamt I had eavesdropped on these houses in their spectral communion and discovered to my horrified surprise that in secret they are the true masters of the street, that they can divest themselves of their vital force and suck it back in again at will, lending it to the inhabitants during the day to demand it back at extortionate interest as night returns. And when I review in my mind all the strange people who live in them, like phantoms, like people not born of women, who, in all their being and doing, seem to have been put together haphazardly, out of odds and ends, then I am more than ever inclined to believe that such dreams carry within them dark truths which, when I am awake, glimmer faintly in the depths of my soul like the after images of brightly coloured fairy tales. Then it is that a ghostly legend wakes to new life in the hidden recesses of my mind, the legend of the golem, that man-made being that long ago a rabbi versed in the lore of the Kabbalah formed from elemental matter and invested with mindless automatic life by placing a magic formula behind its teeth. And just as the golem returned to inert clay immediately, the arcane formula was removed from its mouth. So, I imagine, must all these people fall lifeless to the ground the very second a minuscule something is erased in their brains. In some, the glimmer of an idea, a trivial ambition, a pointless habit, perhaps. In others, merely a dull expectation of something vague and indefinite. And the constant furtive look in their eyes. You never see them work, these creatures. And yet they are up early at the first flicker of dawn, waiting with bated breath, as if for a victim that never comes. If it ever happens that someone enters their territory, someone defenceless they can fleece, then they are immediately paralysed by a fear which sends them scuttling back into their holes, trembling, discarding all their skulking designs. There seems to be no one so weak that they have the courage to seize him. So, it is worth going into the figure, the law of the golem, because the golem, not only as the literal golem that appears horribly in the book, there's a few times where the golem is there, walking past the golem and noticing this dead, lifeless, for those that are familiar with the esoteric history, it's almost like also an individualized egregore. The palpable grey quagmire of the ghetto enfolded into a ritualized being that is hollow. And this notion of seeing that being and being overwhelmed by the nothingness of this being, of the fact that it is a possessed being. And so alongside this paranoia, this usage, and you see a lot of Myrink uses words like, your life and vitality being sucked away into something. So this paranoia of something is using people within this ghetto. There is, on top of that, this other notion of puppetry and possession. So everything not only is reality into question, but the agency of what is being used within the reality is within question. And the weirdness just builds and builds and builds. And it's a novel that has almost no trust. But, and this is from, so this is actually in the introduction called Gustav Meyrink and His Golem. That's by Robert Irwin, written in 1985. And he says this of the Golem. And this is at the beginning of this edition. What is the golem? What is a golem? In Old Testament Hebrew, the word seems to have meant the unformed embryo. In medieval Jewish philosophy, the term designated chayil, or matter, which had not been shaped by form. More curiously, Hasidic mystics in 12th, 13th century Germany are known to have practiced an obscure ritual which aimed to use the Kabbalistic power of the Hebrew alphabet and manipulate the material form of the universe to create a golem. It was from these philosophical and mystical usages that a group of legends about the golem evolved to become one of the stock themes of Jewish folklore and Yiddish literature. In these legends, a man-like monster of clay is created by a rabbi or other student of the Kabbalah and is given life by inscribing Emeth, truth, on its brow. The creature can be deactivated by removing the first letter, leaving it immobilized under the power of Meth, death. In some stories, the attraction of this primitive Jewish version of the robot is that it can labor in the synagogue on Saturdays. Though in the golem story attached to the 16th century Rabbi Lo of Prague, the rabbi is careful to remove the crucial letter every Saturday evening. In most of the tales, there comes a point where the rabbi or cultist forgets to remove the letter of power and the creature grows in power and goes on a rampage. In some stories, it is only disabled at the cost of its creator's life as the monstrous thing of clay tumbles down upon its master. There are clear affinities in the legend of the golem with tales about the Paracelsian homunculus and the sorcerer's apprentice and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and for that matter with the stories of Tibetan tulpas who escape their mystic master's control. And so we have something that is being, you know, we're thinking here of the Industrial Revolution has settled in. We are beginning into this age of commercialization, of things such as ghettos, of perhaps consumerism, of the birth of maybe corporatism, the birth of really clear factory work, the birth of this kind of thing of people being seen as being transformed into an automaton, into a machine, being sucked into those machinations. And what's interesting, with regards to Myrink is heavily, heavily, and I mean heavily, saturated. He's saturated with esoteric lore. Some of it incredibly obscure. He is a exceedingly well-read esotericist. And so you have this combination of the birth of factory work and the birth of that human automaton, which now some people might call the NPC, this sort of dead zombie-like worker. You have that mixed with esoteric notions of the golem, or as Irwin says there, the tulpa, or as I mentioned, the egregore, though the egregore is more of a societal notion. And so there's this uncanny combination of the industrialized grey working hustle and bustle of the ghetto mixed with the mysticism of ages that are just about dying, but they can't get rid of. And so when you confront this notion of the golem within this context, it gives you a deep sense of dread of being out of time, out of place. What are we to do with this now? And so I think because Myrink, outside of the golem, he's most well known for the golem, though all his other books, they're highly rated, and Daedalus Press has published, I believe, the majority, almost all of his work now in translation. But Myrink is it's worth having giving a brief biography of Meirink here, because it's a strange, strange life. So Meirink is born in 1868. He's not of Jewish descent. He lives in Prague for 20 years and is depicted, this is depicted many times in his work, and the ghetto and Prague very much are palpable characters of their own. And whilst he was living in Prague, there was a providential event in his life. He, at 24 years old, he was allegedly on the assumption, on the eve of assumption, and this is from his autobiographical short story, The Pilot. He was standing at his table with a gun to his head, ready to commit suicide. And he heard a strange scratching sound at the door. And someone put a booklet under his door. The booklet was called Afterlife. I couldn't find anything actually of the actual booklet itself, but it was called Afterlife. And it was obviously to do with the afterlife and these sort of mystical notions. And after that, he was surprised by this sort of, I guess, synchronicity, this strange coincidence, and he began to study the literature of the occult, theosophy, Kabbalah, sophiology, Eastern mysticism. And he eventually does convert, I believe, at the end of his life to Buddhism. And then he, until his death, he practices yoga and occult exercises, and this is all completely thrown into his work. He was in 1902, he's charged with fraud due to using spiritualism to benefit from banking operations. He's released from jail after 2 months, and those experiences are depicted in The Golem. So Meirink is an individual there is not a single moment in The Golem and his other the brief bits of his other writing that I've read where there is any doubt in his mind with respect to the reality of the mystical world. And his approach to the occult is very much one of a question. And I don't know what the question he is asking is, and I think maybe that's a way to approach The Golem, is to ask yourself, what is it that Meirink is trying to figure out? What is the question here? Because his approach to occultism, and this is the novel is steeped in the tarot, it's steeped in the Kabbalah, it's steeped in theosophy and Eastern mysticism. If you know your esoteric history and you know your esoteric symbols and ideas, you'll have a field day with this. But he approaches it in a way of almost panicked questioning, as if he has to figure something out very, very quickly. And so you enter into something that can only ever doubt itself, with this dreams, with the reality of the spiritual realm. But at the same time, you're also thrown into the reality, I think, of the dawn of the modern world, having to deal with mystical notions being utilized within that framework, which perhaps isn't as sympathetic to it, which causes a deep sense of uncanny. And then amidst this, as soon as this golem, this figure of possession, of ritualized possession, of this sort of empty, horribly possessed empty vessel that is just wandering around almost as a potent signifier of the deadness of this new world that is here. Once that the golem is implicated, is put into the story, it never leaves the back of your mind. You know that in the ghetto there's this sort of horrible, haunting golem always wandering around that you don't want to be near. And it's pretty much, I mean, it's an almost limitless symbolism with regards to the golem. It's not entirely sure whether or not it's a villain or something akin to that. I think it would be very lazy to consider the golem a villain. But there is everything in it. War, community, isolation, hope, modernity, the possession of the masses, puppetry, paranoia, and unreliability. Everything is just continually questioned. And so what we're following, even though we're following Pernath, who is a very sympathetic figure most of the time, I would say, We're also not following Pernath because there's a narrator that has possessed Pernath, and so this leads us by the end to question what happened altogether. So this is why you have to step back and say, hang on, what are we doing? We're following a dreamer on a journey that is constantly being, is constantly butting up against what reality exactly is. All at once, I understood the innermost nature of the mysterious creatures that lived around me. They drift through life with no will of their own, animated by an invisible magnetic current, just like the bridal bouquet floating past in the filthy water of the gutter. I felt as if the houses were staring down at me with malicious expressions full of nameless spite. The doors were black, gaping mouths in which the tongues had rotted away, throats which might at any moment give out a piercing cry, so piercing and full of hate that it would strike fear to the very roots of our soul. And so this sort of esoteric, conspiratorial paranoia begins to build. And if you invest yourself too deeply into the questioning that I already mentioned, which I think is a good approach to the novel, you can begin to sort of feel, perhaps, a little mad. Where are you being taken? And this question is directly taken up a little. This is maybe a quarter into the novel. I was just thinking about the way those coats started flapping earlier on, Prokop answered quickly, as if to excuse his silence. Isn't it strange the way the wind makes inanimate objects move? Doesn't it look odd when things which usually just lie there lifeless suddenly start fluttering? Don't you agree? I remember once looking out onto an empty square, watching huge scraps of paper whirling angrily round and round, chasing one another as if each had sworn to kill the others. And I couldn't feel the wind at all, since I was standing in the lee of a house. A moment later, they seemed to have calmed down, but then they were seized once more with an insane fury and raced all over the square in a mindless rage, crowding into a corner, then scattering again as some new madness came over them, until finally they disappeared round a corner. There was just one thick newspaper that couldn't keep up with the rest. It lay there on the cobbles full of spite, flapping spasmodically as if it were out of breath and gasping for air. As I watched, I was filled with an ominous foreboding. What if, after all, we living beings were nothing more than such scraps of paper? Could there not be a similar unseeable, unfathomable wind blowing us from place to place and determining our actions whilst we, in our simplicity, believe we are driven by our own free will? What if the life within us were nothing other than some mysterious whirlwind, the wind of which it says in the Bible, "Thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth"? Do we not sometimes dream we have plunged our hands into deep water and caught silvery fish, when all that has happened is that our hands have been in a cold draught? Prokop, you're talking like Pernath. What's wrong with you? Asked Zvak, giving the musician a suspicious look.
There's distrust at all turns. And I think the thing that holds throughout the novel is the ghetto. We're placed into this ghetto with the ultimate of unreliable, possessed, puppeted narrators, Pernath, who is quite literally possessed. And within that possession, we're not entirely sure whether or not we're within the dream. But it is the ghetto, I think. There's the ghetto of Prague that seems to be the primary character in a way. It may very well be the case that the breakdown that Pernath had was because of the conditions of this ghetto, and that this esoteric journey is him trying to deal with perhaps some deeper form of esoteric lineage-type trauma or something along these lines. It's a possible journey back to sanity, where if you, the reader, invest yourself in any area too much, you will give yourself over to a sort of form of saturated weirdness and insanity that you can only escape by allowing things to be. Everything is questionable. Everything can be doubted. There is something else at play. Everything is driven by a different force. And yet we are carried along by Meyrink and Mitchell's great translation, by Meyrink's strange, romantic, possibly esoterically romantic, rich, yet suspicious language. It's symbolic in the way that a symbol always conceals something. And so this is a book of ceaseless second guessing. And you will get to the end and think, I'm not sure what just happened, who to trust, but I feel different. And it has the effect that a Kenneth Grant novel or Beelzebub's Tales by Gurdjieff has. It has that sort of self-hypnotic, auto-hypnotic effect where you really feel lightened. And so the end, and this is and is not a spoiler, this is right at the beginning of the section titled End at the End, which of course is suspicious in itself. Like a lump of fat. That is the stone that looks like a lump of fat. The words are still ringing in my ears. Then I sit up and try to remember where I am. I'm in bed, in my hotel. And I'm not called Pernath. Was it all a dream? No, dreams are not like that. I look at the clock. I've hardly been asleep for an hour. It's 2:30. And there on the hook is someone else's hat that I took by mistake in the cathedral today, while I was sitting in a pew during High Mass. Is there a name in it? I take down the hat. In gold letters on the white silk lining is the unknown and yet so strangely familiar name. Athanasius Pernath. What happened? Who did we just follow? We were in the ghetto, that seemed stable. Why the golem? We don't really know. But it's a journey. And if you're interested in esoteric literature, as in esoteric fiction, as in esoterically symbolic novels, if you're interested in weird fiction, the likes of Arthur Machen, H.P. Lovecraft, of course, and writers along these lines, then Meyrink is one of the strangest examples. And this novel in particular is prescient for a multitude of reasons, not least because of the flexibility and plasticity of this symbol of the golem, as not only as a communal egregore type symbol of the masses being drawn along by strings, but one's relationship to it, and also as the individual, the sort of the dead zombie-like worker. But if you want to just go into an atmospheric journey and feel yourself strange, you could read this novel at any time of the day, and if you allow yourself to be taken into it, be taken into this subtle, almost pleasant, rich, wine-like madness, then it's thoroughly enjoyable. But if you go in seeking a plot in the usual sense, though it's not an experimental novel, but if you go in seeking an answer that plots can usually give, the answers only come in the sense of a difference between being correct and truth. And so each thing has to be investigated. Everything is a symbol to be doubted. If you want to almost enter into an esoteric mystery, which is like digestion, you will be digesting this intellectually for weeks to come, then read this. There are, of course, great times to read this. I would recommend, you know, dimming the lights, lighting a candle, and reading it in the early hours or even the twilight hours. That would be the perfect time. But outside of this, I can only say that I'm in agreement with H.P. Lovecraft, the most magnificent weird thing I've come across in aeons. And in terms of palpable weirdness, it'll be a while until anything tops the golem. So, that is my brief look and thoughts and short review of Gustav Meyrink's The Golem, published by Daedalus, with the translation by Mike Mitchell. I hope you enjoyed, and thanks for listening.